imagine a person who is listening who has been having vague symptoms. They're not entirely sure why. They have just listened to your word choice of a brain fog or not being able to explain why they are substantially fatigued, or perhaps there is a intermittent and perhaps food-related problems with nausea. How do you determine whether somebody who has these vague symptoms that aren't clearly associated at all with eating, how do you know whether that is or is not a food allergy?
Yeah,
or food sensitivity?
Sure. So when we I will say, in general, when we think of food allergy, the way I also explain it to patients is your immune system in general is not going to choose a bad day and a good day. In general, if you are allergic, a reaction should happen most of the time, if not every time you are exposed. And by virtue of that, when you have adults coming into clinic, most of them have been eating many of the foods in question for quite a while without having, obviously, a life-threatening or an anaphylactic reaction. So by default, many of the patients that I see, I'm automatically thinking, could this be some form of food intolerance or food sensitivity? And so I usually, just like you had sort of brought up earlier, I do start with a conversation about the timing and what are the actual symptoms themselves. And if there is enough concern there that, you know, this could potentially be an anaphylactic or food allergy, then I go through exactly what we're doing on your arm right now of this skin test or blood test. At the very least, to try to rule that out, because there, that really changes my thinking. If there is a food allergy, like I mentioned before, we're talking about strict avoidance, so not even any cheating at all, and then epinephrine, and really thinking about 911 anytime you get into this stuff. So typically there, the first thing I'm trying to do is rule out, whether in my mind or in a test form, the food allergy. Then with the sensitivities, again, here it's much more difficult because at this stage, there really isn't great research on what is happening here. Folks are starting to do that by lumping all the patients together under this term non-celiac gluten. I think they've been able to sort of gather patients and start to look into what in the world may be happening. But at this point, I'm not aware of any blood tests, immune tests, anything like that, that has been very clearly diagnostic of this. And it probably makes sense because we don't even know the mechanism. We don't know why in the world this is happening. And so at this point, diagnostic testing is very difficult. And so what we end up doing is basically a food elimination and a reintroduction diet.
So let's describe a food elimination diet. What do? You start with what?
Right. So again, we, through the conversation, try to figure out what the highly suspected food may be. For many patients out there, it will be gluten. And so we would start with one food at a time, trying to change as little as possible. But the idea there would be, for example, for gluten, really going out there, reading every single label for everything that they're eating and trying to strictly avoid this food. Typically in my clinic, I'll say for a minimum of 2 weeks, but many folks will advertise up to 4 to 6 weeks strictly avoiding this. So no cheating at all. And then just really continuing to monitor the key symptoms that they're having, so whether related to the stomach or the fatigue or otherwise. And it's not a perfect test, but really there, then what we're looking for is a very, very obvious improvement, if not a complete sort of cure, really, of the symptoms.
And the outside time frame there is what, 4 to 6 weeks?
Typically, yes. So about 4 to 6 weeks. And again, easier said than done, for sure,
right.
Especially something like gluten, which is just as prevalent everywhere. But then, you know, that part, a lot of patients are on board. Actually, many patients are already doing when they come and see me. But the hard part, which takes a lot of convincing from me, is then to reintroduce it. So, okay, sure, we have found that you're not eating it now and you feel all these things have gotten much, much, much better and you're just happy. And then I'm going to tell you, go ahead and eat 10 bagels and see what happens. And the looks that I get from patients are exactly the look that you just gave me of disbelief of, what are you saying? I just got better. Why? And the thought there would be, by reintroducing, if we actually do see the symptoms come roaring back, well, yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect test, but it gives us a little more confidence that, yeah, this really is the trigger here and I'm not avoiding the food just because, but there really is a connection. Now, can I say for sure after that test that it is absolutely a gluten intolerance and there is a mechanism, whether immune or otherwise? I can't say that, but I think it gives us more reason for the avoidance.
Patients should trust their own instincts, in other words, if they're not feeling well. What's the information like out on the web that folk can look at? If you look online, you see all sorts of interesting and complicated and faddish diets. What you're describing is a very simple eliminating one food at a time, mm-hmm. but on the web, There's all sorts of other information. Where do you tell people to look and how to filter what is out there?
Yeah, so I do want to quickly talk about the diets, because you mentioned sort of the faddish diets, and that is something that is complicating the whole picture. So there are a lot of sort of gluten elimination type of diets that have been advertised out there, and a lot of people do feel better from those type of diets, and perhaps because of better nutrition, perhaps of being more aware of what they're eating or whatever it may be. And so I do think it sort of muddies the water for the folks who have, again, what seems like this real non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So the diets, again, not necessarily bad, but it does confuse things that are out there. And just like you said, there is a lot of information out there. And really, if you look hard enough, you can probably find almost anything you want in the internet. And so typically what I usually tell my patients is to try to focus on sort of the big medical sites that are out there. So say a Medscape or a WebMD. Probably the areas where people run into the most trouble are going to be the personal blogs and folks who have sort of made themselves self-made experts. And I don't think that these folks are making anything up. I think they're absolutely telling their own story. But the problem there is that their story may not line up with most of the other people out there. And I think that's the piece that sometimes gets lost in there. And so, if some folks want to look at some of these areas just for some reassurance that I'm not alone, again, I don't fault patients for that at all, because, patients are advocating for themselves and for their own health. And I don't think you can fault them for that. But I do very much try to educate them as much as I can on what we know and don't know about these food allergies and food sensitivities. And then again, guide them to these major sites like WebMD and Medscape, like we had talked about.